4. To the White House. I started at the White House in late July 1991 with Officer Leslie Kofelt on my mind. He was the only White House policeman to die in the line of duty, sacrificing his life to protect President Truman while the president resided at Blair House, across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House during its renovations. His story demonstrated how one minute things are fine, and in the next second, two assassins can turn everything to complete shit and a giant gunfight. I felt that I was standing in big shoes. Yet any uniformed division, UD officer, or special agent, SA, will bluntly tell you, you know what it's like to be in the service? Go stand in a corner for 4 hours with a 5 minute pee break, and then go stand for 4 more hours. That's the action, 99% of the time. Have Hollywood make that movie. But for me, it was a dream. I was first assigned to the White House fence line, the perimeter of the White House grounds, the first defense for ground-based assaults and assassination attempts, but far more likely the key to interdicting intelligence gatherers, people up to no good, casing the joint for future action, fence jumpers, pot-shot shooters, and various troublemakers. For all its prestige and grand history, the White House is a shithead magnet. The UD faces all the crazies who think they can solve the world's problems by running, or flying, into the White House and performing some ludicrous stunt. When the executive mansion was first built, it was the president's private living quarters, nothing more. Though visitors need considerably more representative and/or financial clout to see the president, it still remains the people's house in many ways. Yet the taxing 8 o'clock p.m. wake-up calls for an 11 o'clock p.m. to 6 o'clock a.m. night shift, and similarly taxing two-shift days, never gave me a case of the Mondays or had me in a grumpy mood. The introductory six-month hell period had me jumping from bed and doing physical training, PT, before shift start on the White House grounds. By policy, during the first 2.5 years, a UD officer could be terminated without a written reason. It was leadership's insurance in case someone wasn't liked, didn't fit in, was talking out of school, or clearly wouldn't be able to hack it in the long term. Our character was constantly tested. Character was the strongest tool in the Secret Service arsenal. My first arrest occurred when I walked to lunch. Two bums were fist-fighting right in front of me. "Come on, guys," I pled. "I'm friggin' hungry." Bums would often make trouble just so we'd arrest them and give them the shelter, food, and medical care they couldn't or wouldn't provide for themselves. "Public urination, public intoxication, and fighting is not tolerated here, sir." That was my new guy mentality. But I soon learned from the sour looks and heavy sighs of the District of Columbia's Metropolitan Police Department that my diligence was highly unappreciated. Many of these homeless troublemakers were down-on-their-luck people whose minds had snapped from hard times. They came to D.C. thinking that if only the president would listen, their problems would be solved. But some were not indigent. They simply chose that life. How do I know that? Because the full might of the Secret Service ran background checks on them. Soon, nothing surprised me. A woman clutching her child's hand ran toward me. "Officer, officer!" "What is it, ma'am?" There was a man in the park, let's just say, pleasing himself in full view of everyone, even children. She was new to D.C. By now, I wasn't. I knew him by name. We'd arrested him many times before, and I wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of arresting him again. Nor was I going to get the evil eye from the Metro PD for bringing him in to add a notch to his already voluminous rap sheet. "We are not bum catchers," seasoned officers would growl. All we would do was shoo him away as if he was a seagull at a picnic, yelling, "Get the hell out of here! Go on!" Our background check had revealed that he had $40,000 in savings and was a snowbird traveling to Florida in the winter and to D.C. to soak up government benefits the rest of the time. Unbelievable? You don't know D.C. My energetic enthusiasm and sense of workplace cooperation during the first 6 months working the fence line and at other posts created a rapport with fellow officers. Our typical UD action was to strike up a conversation with, question, and, if necessary, detain suspicious characters. We looked for people wearing trench coats in the summertime, or the tourist taking pictures of our security measures. We would often scare them off, detain them, or inspect their cameras pending an investigation. The more they insisted, the more we insisted. The greatest shot a law enforcement officer takes is the one he or she prevents in the first place. We wanted anyone engaged in pre-attack reconnaissance to return to their counterparts and say, "Security is too tough." Appearing tough saves an incalculable number of lives. I was on a vehicle patrol, and we got a call for backup from a K-9 officer. All I heard was her location and something like, "Crazy man with a knife." 50 yards across a DC park, a lady held back her police dog and the man standing off in front of her. I knew I could reach them on foot faster than circling the Jersey barriers by car. I hopped the barricade, drew my pistol, and sprinted. The dog was ready to engage, to tear flesh. The man was within the rarely discussed 23-foot rule. If he sprinted at us, he could potentially plunge his knife in, no matter how many times we shot him. There simply wouldn't be enough kinetic energy to push him back. With each stride, I closed the gap on my own effective shooting range. I yelled out to let her know that I was in her field of fire. If he charged and was on drugs, we had to shoot until he stopped advancing. I yelled. She yelled. Her dog was pulling, snarling, demanding to tear into the man. I got to within 20 feet of him. The sight of three officers, admittedly one four-legged, and two guns pointed at him made him freeze. His eyes met mine. "Put the weapon down, mother effer!" I didn't have to shoot. No one died. We won. He wasn't holding a knife, but it was a rigid foot-long oil dipstick sharpened to a shank and duct-taped with the crudest of handles. It was nasty. The K-9 officer, Bell, observed that her assailant wore so many layers of clothes that he could have wiggled free to stab her dog before the K-9 took him down. If Bell had shot, it would have been justified, but she bided her time, hoping for a better solution. Together, we defused the incident. It didn't make headlines, but these events ride a thin line. Any small change, and anyone could have been seriously injured or killed. Such was life. A year later, a similar incident occurred. A man had taped a knife to his hands and refused to back off. This time, the officer shot, fatally wounding his attacker. Such incidents don't happen every day, but they happen. My most frequent service to the community was looking tough and giving directions to some government building, just as Officer Kofelt had done. Our most common arrests were for bum fights, disorderly conduct, suspicious activity, or fence jumping. The White House fence is clearly scalable by loonies and potential suicide bombers. It's never been raised or made more secure because of the White House Historical Association, a testament to bureaucratic bullshit. Instead of a simple fence fix, more manpower gets deployed, and the Secret Service take over more of D.C., making streets pedestrian only or closing them off from public access entirely. But I wasn't worrying about that in 1991. Local university fraternities thought it was funny to haze newcomers by making them hop the White House fence, touch the fountain, and run back. The Secret Service discreetly informed nearby colleges that the pranks needed to stop. It removed some pressure, but people will keep trying until we send a clear message. There is no chance of success. Electrify the top rung, make it 2 feet higher, or put up another fence behind the other. Fence jumpers have been increasingly successful at penetrating deep into our secure area. On September 20, 2014, a knife-wielding fence jumper successfully ran into the executive mansion. He was tackled by an off-duty agent walking through the mansion at the time. A creeping liberal mindset fueled the problem. Old-timers warned me of it when I first came on board. an odd balance of ensuring protection and not offending anyone's feelings. But we need to empower the warrior mindset, not the liberal one. The White House isn't a kindergarten in which to teach grown people about the value of no trespassing and private property. Every federal agency's solution is more and grow. More manpower, bigger budgets, expand the secure area, close off parks and streets to the public, traffic, or make streets pedestrian only. Why do people jump the fence at the White House? Because it's climbable, that's why. Whether mastermind terrorist or idiot criminal, they all think success is possible. I've had many men and women look me dead in the eye and try persuading me they needed to see the president. You'd better believe I stopped them. When someone came to us at the fence and said, "It's vital I see the president immediately, a matter of national security," we knew they were crazy. If the president would only say a prayer, I'll personally tell him that prayer, and say it while holding three rocks in his hand, all the world's problems would be solved, a lady exclaims to me, holding up three normal-looking rocks. She believed it so fervently. Two such persons, we nodded and said, "I understand, sir, or ma'am. You want to head over there." We'd radio it in and direct the person to special entry control points ready for their arrival and any sort of suicide or attack they might attempt, lighting themselves on fire, drawing a weapon, slashing their own wrists. It bought time to study their movements, survey the surrounding area for other activity, and check for unnatural bulges or weights in their clothing. Officers employed thick, flame-resistant, stab-resistant wool blankets to rush and tackle such wackadoos. It's a method that had been tried and retried often. Simple, thick wool blankets work too, and require zero hesitation on an officer's part. By the time any seriously mentally ill person came in contact with police, it was a systemic failure. We'd take the seriously mentally ill to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, a psychiatric facility, where they'd be committed, treated for a day or three, and then released. When we saw them again, they'd be less trusting, bitter, and off their meds. I underwent a hell of an education in the real world in our nation's capital. In October 1992, I was patrolling the Ellipse Park to the south of the White House in an unmarked van. Three long-haired, bearded guys dressed in blue jeans and green surplus Vietnam-era fatigue jackets were moving calmly and purposefully in tandem, cleaning out a white van and throwing bagged items into a trash can. The van was labeled as a telephone company vehicle, but the men obviously weren't in company uniform. I ran the plates over the radio to our headquarters, Bandbox. They radioed back, "Stolen," and routed backup vehicles. Our three suspects moved like us, like military. One was scanning, the way we do, and spotted me. Silently, he signaled to his associates. They boarded their van calmly but rapidly. As the spotter entered its rear door, I spotted his dagger, a fighting knife, pointed upward under his shirt. Only someone trained in knife fighting would conceal it that way. Reachable by both hands, it was placed where he could deploy it lightning fast. They headed east on E Street toward 15th. I followed closely. They knew the jig was up, but I hadn't hit the lights yet, and they hadn't bolted yet. We silently maneuvered. I wanted to stop them at the construction barriers surrounding the yet uncompleted Reagan building. The radio net was clogged with officers closing in, but we were running out of time. I had my short 12-gauge shotgun out and hidden below the dashboard, and hoped another police car would box them in on the other side. We were in the perfect location for a gunfight, but only if we could block the intersection. And if I could ram the rear doors of the van, they'd have only two points of exit, and I'd have an ideally narrow field of fire. If I had to exit my vehicle while shooting through my window, sure, I'd enjoy some cover in the concrete Jersey barriers, but no cover stands up forever. We were stopped at the light, each biding our time. They watched for traffic to grow so as to run the red light, dart through an opening, and hamstring my pursuit. They ran that light and bolted down 15th, snarling me in traffic. I put pedal to the metal across the 14th Street Bridge to I-395 and then to I-95. I radioed my position to Bandbox. I was in Virginia. Bandbox relayed my watch commander's orders. Break off, turn around, and come back. To hell with that, I thought. But it absolutely was an order. I couldn't be insubordinate, but I knew these guys were up to something seriously evil. The presence of the combat knife solidified that assumption. My watch commander should have trusted my instincts. Twice I pretended I didn't hear the order. Suddenly I saw Virginia police closing in on my tail and was immensely thankful. I looked down at the speedometer. 120 miles per hour. Weaving between cars, we swerved from lane to lane. Our vans wobbled and shook. My prey changed lanes once more. A UD canine officer following me called over, "Watch out, Gary, they're gonna lose it." I took my foot off the gas so I wouldn't run into their van as they flipped. But that driver knew his stuff. He just wobbled and then accelerated again. The chase was still on. Each lane change lurched our vans and every bump rocked our suspensions. The state trooper was still catching up, and I wasn't letting up. I passed a sign for King's Dominion Amusement Park. Hell, I was near Fredericksburg, way past my zone and in the weeds with my watch commander. I gritted my teeth. I planned to jackknife them into spinning their car into the median, but my little Dodge Caravan couldn't close the gap fast enough. Just 15 miles from Richmond, long after that canine officer had bowed out, I had to bow out too. Furious, I raced back to D.C. just as fast because Bandbox kept asking for my location and I kept stalling. Later, when I returned the car to the Washington Navy Yard, the mechanic said, "Gee damn, Gary," and he informed me the car needed a pint of transmission fluid and a quart of oil and was almost completely empty of gas. My watch commander tried to write me up. Why was our leadership so risk-averse? Those guys had been up to something bad. For what other reason would three trained guys have stolen a van and run with such reckless abandon? Officers need leadership that backs them up, but our superiors' trepidation was only getting worse. Our revolvers were swapped for the extremely formidable Sig Sauer 228 pistol, but some posts were issued nickel-plated Remington Model 870 shotguns, meant to shoot beanbags an abysmal 20 feet. Many guys openly refused to use them. As a new guy, I didn't have that clout, but I silently shared their opinion. The service wanted to issue tasers, too. It was all tactically prudent and politically meddlesome. Luckily, every day didn't include a car chase scene from Bullet or the French Connection. We got to deal with some very nice people, too, such as President George H.W. Bush and First Lady Barbara Bush. One day on the South Lawn, when I first walked past First Lady Barbara Bush, she said, "Good morning, officer." I nodded and walked on. Per my JJRTC training, I was taught not to engage protectees in conversation. An agent rushed up to me. "Excuse me, officer, is there something wrong with you?" he scolded. "No, sir," I replied, mortified. When the First Lady says, "Good morning," you stop and say good morning back. Otherwise, they consider it rude. I apologized profusely. I didn't know. It was just one of those things you have to get a feel for on the job. I was extremely loyal to the presidency, not because they were the Bushes, but because they were the first family. And in doing so, I forgot that they were normal folks and regular Americans at heart. The second time the First Lady passed me, they were heading to a vehicle to run an errand. She said good morning, and so did I, which was a relief. The new guy was finally adjusting. "And officer, do tell them to turn down the humidity, please," she said pointedly. I nodded, turned, and picked up the phone on my post. "What is it, Gary?" said the no-nonsense call center. Then I realized we were outside. I looked over. Barbara Bush and the staff were giggling. "Gary, what is it?" the voice snapped. Never mind, I replied, and hung up the phone. She got me again. But her humor kept tension at bay around the White House. Mrs. Bush was famous for it. Executive life was constantly stressful, and it can consume everyone who works at the White House. She knew it and appreciated us, and it meant the world. When I finally finagled a White House tour for my family, one of the Bush grandkids ran down the executive living quarters steps and bumped into my mom. Arthur, a resident houseman, was not happy. He and Mrs. Bush sought us out. Practically dragging two of the Bush boys by the ear, she made them apologize to my mother. And then Mrs. Bush apologized to me for their behavior. I never thought I would hear the end of it from colleagues. I was horrified. I just hoped it wouldn't get me in trouble. But it was how the Bushes operated. 100% class. The permanent executive resident staff is extremely loyal and exemplifies quiet character. They run the White House. Their dedication keeps everything in check. Maybe it's ironic, but I know it's true. Though seemingly at the bottom of the White House hierarchy, the residence crew set the standard for character. Presidents come and go. They stay, thank God. Part of our job was to create a welcoming environment, not a prison for the first family. A smile, a good morning, sir, and simple gestures go a long way in tough times. It took a long presidential history and relationship with the Secret Service to find a balance, and with each president and staff, that balance has to be re-engineered and tailored again. President George H.W. Bush knew what it was to be on the front line, part of the sword and shield of this country. When he enlisted in the Navy, his nickname was Skin because he was so lanky. He piloted an Avenger torpedo bomber against Japanese targets. Taking flak, his engine caught fire, yet he still hit his target before parachuting into the ocean. Defying death again, Bush was picked up by a submarine and spent the rest of his time with that sub on a mission. We all respected him because, in a way, we felt as though the president was one of the guys, albeit of a salty older generation. When he issued orders for a national fight, he understood the consequences of sending people into harm's way. Everyone in the Secret Service respected him for that. He had no Hollywood notions of combat or politically correct ideas of wartime grandeur. Anyone in our shoes, doing our job to protect others, just wants to look back and see the commander's hand still at the helm. The West Wing staff, also known as the political or presidential staff, run the president's policy. But no other group is more committed to the White House and the First Family than the permanent executive resident staff. Many families, like Arthur's, had served for generations. To executive resident staffers, the First Family was royalty. Or maybe these staff members simply understood the burden of the office. I had immense respect for the resident staff's quiet resolve and work ethic, especially during the Easter egg roll and Christmas events. People say the Secret Service would take a bullet for the president, but I tell you that many of the resident staff would too. Yes, the feeling is contagious. The more time I spent working around the president, the more I was hooked. I was being trained for the post outside the Oval Office when we started heading into the election cycle. I witnessed how impeccably the president's morning briefer arrived at 6:50 every single morning, 10 minutes earlier than scheduled. He waited and made small talk until Papa Bush walked into the Oval Office at exactly 7 a.m. Both were incredibly punctual. We joked that we could set our watches by their morning routine. They looked us right in the eye, smiled, and said, "Good morning, officer." They often knew us by name. Such basic actions were so profound. President Bush would say good morning, even if it wasn't a good morning. Stress didn't faze him. He didn't agonize over walking into his office because he knew firsthand of things much worse. He carried a briefcase, as did his briefer. I always wondered why the president needed a briefcase. Everything he wanted could be provided, but it spoke to his work ethic. 7 a.m. wasn't their time. It was the people's. Timberwolf, Bush's code name, understood. He understood what it meant to be presidential. I also watched Papa Bush and his advisors when a group of uniformed Division Emergency Response Team members congratulated him on being chosen by Time magazine as Person of the Year. "Hey guys," the president called over to them, stopping them in their tracks. He signed the magazine and gave it to one of the guys and thanked each profusely for what he did. Things like that, simple, respectful actions, endeared Papa Bush to us. The president's mind was constantly being bombarded, but he thought of us, and some lucky guy was recognized by the president to whom he had dedicated his life and efforts. That guy, whom I knew well, went home to the wife and kids, with whom he had spent less time than with the president's family, with a signed copy of Time magazine, which he framed, and a great story to tell. But we knew better than to confuse the president with the man. He was not our friend, nor should any superior be so misconstrued. Respected? Absolutely. Feared? Certainly revered. The president is never a buddy, though Timberwolf made that hard. He even ordered the creation of horseshoe teams of servicemen and executive residence staffers to compete with. And though he was extremely competitive, he wanted everyone to bring their top game. Politics aside, he was great to us. I served a rotation near the White House press lobby. A Presidential Protection Division, PPD agent, walked up to me to shoot the shit. He anticipated that the president was walking out from a different entrance from the one called in over the radio. Without warning, someone touched me on the shoulder from behind. Startled, I swung around, ready for anything. "Whoa, big guy," said Papa Bush, realizing he'd spooked the hell out of me. "Sorry, Mr. President. You got me good," I said, my heart rate coming down. He smiled and asked me to let out Millie and Ranger, the two first family dogs, as one of them had been peeing on a couch. "No problem, Mr. President," I said. He kept smiling as he walked away. "Jesus, Gary," said the agent. I shrugged, winced, and made a face as if to say sorry. He'd just startled me severely. Papa Bush was stealthy. His footsteps were inexplicably silent in such a creaky old building. The anxious dog was ecstatic when I let him out to the lawn. Timberwolf's light-footedness and friendliness kept us on our toes. One day, George, the White House butler, and Papa Bush came by the south portico with a silver platter stacked with sizzling sausage, burgers, and hot dogs. The Bushes loved to barbecue. By policy, we were not allowed to eat on post, but we weren't supposed to refuse presidential orders. I refused politely, saying something about policy. I, a very fair-skinned oaf of a guy, was stark red in the face. George, a very dark man, turned white. He wanted to teach me a lesson right then in manners. When someone as nice as the Bushes offered me something, I should graciously accept. George also relayed to me a strict, direct presidential order to disseminate all these fantastic meats, which were so good, to the rest of the guys on post. George was a font of good information. He even showed me a spot in which to hide food in a utility closet. I phoned my fellow officers. If I put it over the radio, it would have been a mob scene, that if they sauntered over to the edges of their posts, I would walk to the edge of mine to pass out the meats. I was in a trance with a mouth full of presidentially prepared cuisine. As luck would have it, however, the watch commander swung by, welling with fury. But I had my excuse. "Oh good, you're here. Watch my post. The president ordered me to take this platter and give it to the guys, sir. I can't refuse a presidential order. I'll be right back and you can have some too." I got the hell out of there, tray in hand. The staff used to say, "When the president eats, everybody eats." That kind of leadership is real. I figured the saying applied to every president, but really the saying came from Bush 41's years. He appreciated the lowest on the totem pole because he'd once pounded the Navy pavement. I assumed every president would follow Papa Bush's example. The work ethic, love of country, work environment, and respect for the people serving would be constant, and politics would never matter. Soon the late-night phone calls and special assignments came. We were moving into the election cycle. Hold on to your butts. Protection was never the same twice, especially with candidates. They had no idea what they were getting themselves into. And neither did I. 5. Meet the new boss. A brief, to-the-point conversation at a 1992 Bill Clinton campaign rally rocked our procedures. A man walked up to an agent. The agent looked the man over. No normal person addressed an agent with the protectee less than a stone's throw away, but the man had a bone to pick. He had the agent's attention. "Do you guys have any idea what you're doing?" he sneered, gesturing to the agents surrounding Clinton. "I'm a sheriff's deputy, and while I am legally allowed to carry, no one screened me. I've got a loaded 1911 pistol on my hip, and if I had a mind to, well, I'm within 10, 15 feet of your boy. Anyone here could be like me, but less inclined to be nice, and there's not a damn thing you could do about it. Now, you sure you guys have your act together?" Alarm bells sounded throughout the service. Bean counter service leaders had dismissed magnetometers as too expensive, and campaign staffers wanted the Secret Service to screen crowds super fast. In reality, an appearance only. There was an open call that day for volunteers to run metal detectors at campaign events. Emergency was an understatement. I signed up. It took Robert Kennedy's assassination to spur assigning Secret Service protection to candidates, just as it took Jack Kennedy's assassination to finally grant us a counter-sniper detail. Secret Service vets told stories of unboxing the new on-the-road metal detectors straight from Italy after Ronald Reagan's assassination attempt. A special detail had sped to Italy with a big bag of taxpayer cash to buy the metal detectors directly from the manufacturer. My 1992 trip wasn't as frenzied, but it was stressful. The Secret Service couldn't hire personnel for every election and then not retain them. It's not feasible, and it wouldn't garner quality personnel. Most agents don't guard POTUS, President of the United States, FLOTUS, First Lady, or the Vice President. As Treasury Department employees, they investigate currency crimes out of nationwide field offices, FOs, but when the election cycle arrives, protection is all hands-on-deck priority. Yet, we could stretch election-level personnel only so far. Occasionally, we called upon agencies like the Drug Enforcement Administration to fill gaps, but never the FBI because of long-standing interagency pissing contests. Sure, local police forces can provide perimeter protection, but even they have trouble protecting at large events. Travel duty agents stay at 4 or 5-star hotels closer to, or at, the same location as the event and/or protectee. We stayed a few miles out in roach motels. A slap in the face, but not worth getting excited about. I was at the center of the political action. As long as we, the Secret Service, weren't in the news and the candidate was, mission complete. As a new guy, I was Teflon to stress. A sudden late-night call, a plane ride, a 2-star hotel, ensuring some crazy event went smoothly in terms of security, another hotel stay, another plane, and I was back home to Maryland and then back to outside the Oval Office. Each special assignment unfolded like that. A dream, a nightmare, a whirlwind, and then back to our normal grind. I was on complete autopilot. I always feared being so exhausted that I might do something incredibly stupid, like accidentally leaving my pistol in a restroom stall. Unforgivable. But stuff like that happened. If you have a healthy fear of screwing up, you're fine. Lose the fear, careers or lives are over. Thieves once broke into a counter-sniper Secret Service Suburban parked next to a diner, and a strip bar, but they were in the diner. They swore. Guns disappeared. So did the agents. I admit I'd grown sentimental regarding Papa Bush and his family. But I knew we protected the president, not the man. I quickly grew to love the routine and the atmosphere, and to sometimes even read the White House morning news briefings, a mosaic of all the major papers' headlines assembled for the president for his morning read. Seeing how candidates and pundits critiqued the president wounded me. Didn't they realize how soul-sucking the presidency was? This was how the political game was played. But didn't candidates realize such vitriol would soon turn on them if they won? I knew Clinton would beat Papa Bush. I read the papers. I worked at his events. Candidate Clinton would become President Clinton, and that person would be under my protection, and I had to adhere to, you elect him, we protect him, 100%. Scandals have often plagued candidates, but the Clintons exceeded any politician's call of duty. Mrs. Clinton coined her vast right-wing conspiracy phrase a few years later, but back in November 1992, I chalked up the hype that surrounded them as just that, hype. As the Clinton scandals accumulated, however, in the months and years to come, I kept recalling being on detail at a Clinton campaign event, small-talking with an Arkansas sheriff. When I asked about the Clintons' latest rumors, he gave me a 1,000-yard stare. Let me tell you something, Gary. Everything they say about them is true. The Clintons are ruthless, and the media don't even know the half of it. I didn't know what to make of that. From what I've seen, he continued, there's no doubt in my mind they will secure the presidency. You watch. How can you be so sure? I asked, especially with all the scandals, the allegations of affairs, bribery. He just waved me off, saying, it will never matter. Officer, I'm telling you, they can spin shit into gold. He spoke with great conviction, looking me straight in the eye, as if knowing that what he said was stranger than fiction. He spoke from a profound well of personal experiences with the Clintons, and it was eerie. Sometimes it seemed as though the Clinton campaign staff could get nothing right, and they blamed us for many scheduling problems, among other issues. Many campaign staffers were bushy-tailed, unpaid college kids eyeing future administration jobs. Woefully undisciplined, ideological, naive, inexperienced sophisticates, they tried to college their way out of any problem. The campaign pushed event volunteers ragged, treating them as disposable. The Clintons' young blood didn't mix with ours, and when those volunteers graduated to campaign staffers, their egos skyrocketed. They still had to cooperate with us to guarantee Clinton's protection, but were pissed to ask permission at every step. They complained it slowed them to a crawl and jeopardized their chances at success. Even more, they suspected we would enact sabotage on behalf of President Bush. They even voiced those conspiracy theories around us. It all set the groundwork for a very bad working relationship between the Clintons and the Secret Service. Their staffers wanted the candidate to succeed. We wanted him to live. Previously, they had free rein over events. Now they played by a different set of rules. And they didn't like rules. For a campaign event, they had purchased a very large banner with the new slogan. We vetoed it. It blocked one of our countersnipers. Later, when Clinton was president, they had scheduled a classic photo op descending Air Force One's staircase. Its pilots nearly panicked to see some staffer had placed a set of audience bleachers near the taxiway. Air Force One jet engine exhaust would have blown people right off them. I feared I'd have to helplessly witness a presidential assassination. Some events resembled a Black Friday sale opening, with Clinton's enthusiastic fans mobbing him. The Clintons embodied their fans' wants, dreams, and political desires. At Clinton events, it was hard to separate fanatics from lunatics. Really, what's the difference? I passed it off as being my first Secret Service election cycle. I thought I'd get used to it. We at the Secret Service UD had plenty of redundancies on our end to ensure safety, If a metal detector malfunctioned, we funneled people over to the next one or used our wands. But if, for whatever reason, and it had happened, the generators failed from overload or ran out of gas, what then? The service didn't want to let in unscanned people. The campaign staff insisted on it, ordering us to speed it up. We placated them, but I was thinking, can you speed up stitching a wound? Sometimes they ordered us to just let everyone through because we looked too authoritative and intimidating. They had no clue that was how behavioral screening worked. On some events, we had campaign staff run up to us archway by archway, yelling, "The event is about to start. Shut it down now. Just do it." Those were awkward and dangerous moments. With gritted teeth, we would explain that we took our orders only from Secret Service hierarchy. Unless my superior gave the order directly, I wouldn't change course. Once, the other UD officers gave in, turning off the metal detectors and just letting them through. I was so angry, I chose to keep my post on and screened each person. The people already in my line were not happy, and the staffer insisted, "What do you not understand? Shut it down." "Are you Secret Service?" I asked. "No, but I'm working this event." "I don't take orders from you. I take orders from the Secret Service. You want me to stop doing my job? Go get someone I take orders from." Sometimes I'd get backing from a superior. Sometimes not. Just like she said, shut it down, Byrne. If I really wanted to push it further, I'd say, "Then give me a name." "What do you mean, give me a name?" "I want to know where this order is coming from," I said, as I flipped open my notepad. They didn't like it, but I needed a name to fall back on if I was ever charged with dereliction. Once I was working a White House metal detector, and a nondescript middle-aged guy halted before the table, eyeing the detectors. His hands entered his pockets, such a simple gesture, but such a red flag. Also on duty was a UD officer whom I'll call Yolanda. We had incredibly different backgrounds. I grew up in Pennsylvania and Virginia. She was from the real D.C., the ghetto, as she said. She was very crass and, like me, never had advanced education. I wasn't sure what to make of her. Anyway, back to that guy at the metal detector. "I have a gun," he said quietly. "In my pockets," he said, his face white, his body rigid. I grabbed his hands, keeping them and his gun in his coat pockets. "Do not take your hands out of your pockets." Yolanda's arm flashed over my hunched shoulder, her SIG pistol so close to his eyeballs, he probably saw the bullet inside its barrel. He certainly saw dark nail polish. "I got you, Bernie." Everybody froze. "Listen," Yolanda barked. "You move and I will kill you, mother effer." Mission accomplished. People didn't complain about screeners after that. A million things could have gone south at that checkpoint, but she had my back, and our training kicked in. Yolanda was great, a top draft pick for any partner. She read people like a human polygraph machine and wouldn't freeze up in the clutch. And that incident occurred at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Just consider the risk at campaign events. 6. The boy from Hope, Arkansas. The new presidential staff was in, and the old was out. I found myself saying, "Good morning, Mr. President," to a new person, President Clinton. The transition was exciting. I spent much of those shifts answering questions like where the coffee machines were, how the White House AT&T telephone system and the fax machines worked, how to navigate the offices, and, of course, the location of the nearest bathroom. Electrical outlets were in short supply in an old building, so I was often asked where to find one. Most often, I'd pester presidential staff to wear their passes visibly. New staff arrived by the day. We codenamed the first family: Eagle, Bill, Evergreen, Hillary, and Energy, Chelsea. They moved into the executive mansion. Mrs. Clinton's office near the Oval Office made her the first lady on the West Wing. The media buzzed over her semi-cabinet position, that she could never be fired, how she'd always be first to the president's ear. Should a first lady be a social role model or an unfireable unofficial chief of staff? We were eager to learn that ourselves. George Stephanopoulos, we nicknamed him Stuffing Envelopes, among other things, and Dee Dee Myers, both key Clinton media people, stood outside the Oval Office, discussing who would get each office. Some had windows or direct access to the president, while some were more secluded and isolated from the annoying buzz of busybodies. They were choosing offices before they knew their exact job positions. I injected myself into their conversation. Typically, the press secretary's office is over there by the press lobby, so reporters can have better access. George turned pale. I wasn't sure how to gauge his reaction. Oh, I don't want my office by those people. George owed reporters for his campaign successes, but I suppose even he wanted a break from the spin cycle. George ended up next to the president's study, granting him coveted open access to the president. Nancy Hernreich, the president's scheduler, had wanted that same office, but ended up next to Betty Curry, the president's personal secretary. Dee Dee Myers, who became the press secretary, ended up with that far office by the press lobby. Many staffers were stalwart professionals. Some sprouted massive egos upon stepping through the White House door. I was on break when I heard a call over the radio. Bandbox to any available West Wing officer. Byrne here. Byrne, proceed to the pool and check on an unidentified male in the pool. Someone needs to go check this guy out immediately. Byrne, copy, I said as I jogged over. The First Family has its own private pool. Once, when First Lady Bush swam there, a rat, the White House has all sorts of wildlife, dove into the pool. President Bush rushed over, beat the rat with a pool net, scooped it up, and flung it onto the walkway nearby. Their English Springer Spaniel Millie finished the job. No rats swam today, but an unknown man in a suit and tie had his feet in the pool, his pants rolled up as if he were on vacation. He was looking around, la-di-da, and kicking his bare feet, leaning back and gawking at the sky. Hey, how you doing? I asked, sincerely curious. He looked at me bright-eyed. Isn't this great? Sure is, I humored him. We made it. We did it, he said, astonished by his own success. We're going to change everything. He talked and talked. Some of these new Clinton hires were really something. Mind if I see your pass? I interrupted. It was in his desk, he told me. I asked his name and he told me we could be friends. But when I radioed Bandbox to check his name, the man's tone changed. He waved me off saying he didn't need a pass. I informed him he did. He responded, "We run the place now. You're going to have to get used to that." I responded with a flat, "Yeah, no." My colleagues arrived, and his feet left the pool. He blustered that we had it in for him, launching into a "Do you know who I am?" routine. He never got his White House pass back. Good riddance. Another day, I was outside the Oval Office. A portly gentleman strutted in with another gentleman, as if they were a two-man marching band. The plump conductor and a tall, hovering young guy marched in lockstep, scrutinizing the West Wing. I assessed them as non-threats, but they had my curiosity. The conductor was brightly dressed, tieless, but wearing multiple brightly colored Mardi Gras beaded necklaces. He got right up in my face. "You see this?" he said, presenting his necklaces the way I'd hold up a badge. "Yes, sir, I do," I said, smiling, being as professional as I could. Inside, I was cracking up. "This is my gay pride necklace. You got a problem with that?" he steamed, eyes locked on mine. "No problem, sir," I replied. He seemed stunned. He trundled off, almost disappointed that I didn't have more to say. I didn't have a problem. He had his pass and wasn't posing a risk, so what did I care? The guy seemed to want to lock horns just because I was a law enforcement officer. He must have figured that anyone wearing a badge must be homophobic. He couldn't be more wrong. My Air Force roommate was a bit of a shut-in. Only when I stopped in a dive bar far off base for a rest stop and heard, "Gary?" did I grasp why. It was he, and only then did I realize where we were. The joint had a motorcycle theme, but in a village people sort of way. A gay bar. My roommate. I waved goodbye and speechlessly peeled out of there. This was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Active homosexuality could result in a dishonorable discharge. Even the suspicion of homosexuality could destroy your career. Suddenly, his awkwardness in the showers, why he never chased women, joked about porn, or made crude military talk, made sense. He must have chewed his fingernails, worrying whether I would spread the word or inform a superior. Gut-wrenching fear must have weighed on him from the start. I drew the big picture. His sexuality had no impact on his competence, honor, or integrity. I respected him more for his commitment to the military. Back home, I gave him a slap on the shoulder and never mentioned it again. Back to 1992 and seeing this oaf saunter down the White House hallway with his beaded necklace. Mr. Mardi Gras had only just begun having his tall, young sidekick slap gay pride stickers on the walls and furniture. Yes, the priceless historical furniture and walls of the White House. "Sir, sir!" Careers were on the line, so I needed backup. The duo pivoted toward me and got the fracas they wanted, a pointless quarrel with those whose job it was to protect them. "I don't care what's on the stickers. Do not disrespect, disregard, or vandalize the White House. This isn't your dorm room. It's a living monument to the greatest leaders this country's ever had." "Oh no, this is our house now," they squawked. They accused us of homophobia. We focused on decorum, protocol, and vandalism. I never expected such behavior from anyone capable of even potentially being appointed to work in the White House. Imagine that after clearing every background check, they demonstrate such willful, unthinkable incompetence, unprofessionalism, and contempt. The West Wing cleaning staff painstakingly removed the offending stickers from the walls, straining not to leave marks. They were angrier than we were. We escorted those clowns out as if we were club bouncers. They never got their passes back, and we never saw them again. Staffers entered through the old executive office building, the Eisenhower building, and it was a magnet for various and sundry weirdos. A polite, well-dressed, and impeccably groomed guy got in line. No problem. Secret Service checked his bag. A-okay. He chit-chatted with the officers. All was normal. Yet the staffer was sockless on one foot. For some reason, he handed an officer the missing sock. "Oh, and I guess I give you this," he said, shrugging and smiling as if he was hot shit, as if nothing were wrong. "Sure do," the officer said, taking the sock. The other officer instinctively drew his sidearm and issued orders. "Keep your hands where I can see them. Hands up!" Next I heard over the radio, "Officers have just apprehended a staffer trying to enter with a pistol." That sock had a Glock pistol in it. The District of Columbia ranks among the nation's most anti-gun locations in the country, and this new staffer was blatantly committing dozens of gun-related felonies just by possessing a handgun. He was fired, arrested, and prosecuted. He basically told UD that the rules didn't apply to him. Idiot. But it takes one to hire one, I was learning. The incident was especially incredible, knowing the Clintons' anti-Second Amendment sentiment. "Beware the Glock in a sock," we'd say to remind each other to keep an eye on staffers as much as anyone else. The word was out on the new staff and the Clinton way of doing things. The hippie generation was anti-authority and disdained us. But now they were the authority. The UD quickly grew wary of being in the sights of the Clintons, and later, especially of Mrs. Clinton. One time, when the president stayed at a West Coast hotel, a group was scheduled to meet with him. It's no secret that Mrs. Clinton and their staff created very tight schedules to enable President Clinton to meet a multitude of groups. But President Clinton was a schmoozer, wanting to give each group due time. Schedules got pushed back and squeezed. Staffers made up time where they could. Downstairs in the lobby, the staffer swore to the agent that she knew each person, but he insisted on verifying each visitor. She pressured him, and he trusted her. Upstairs, people entered completely unscreened. No metal detection, no ID checking, nothing. One guy rushed right up to President Clinton, gave him a hearty handshake, and exclaimed that he was his biggest fan. Clinton asked who he was, but nobody knew. The agents rushed him out. The staffer responsible for this fiasco turned to the agent and, to her credit, surrendered her radio, ID, and credentials, resigning immediately. Wrapped up in the president's schedule, she had left his life completely in God's hands, taking it out of the services. Our mystery man informed agents that he didn't even know the president was staying in the hotel, was simply inquisitive about the group gathering in the lobby, and joined in on a whim. A guy curious about a crowd pierced the most protective security blanket in the world because of a frazzled, overzealous, power-tripping staffer. John Hinckley did pretty much the same damn thing with the press corps. Secret Service leadership reminded us not to trust staffers when it came to presidential security. Many, including myself, maintained detailed notes of every staff encounter in our post logbooks. Cover your ass notes to guard against possible mishaps or claims of libel, sexual harassment, unprofessionalism, or partisanship. Unlike their predecessors, this administration didn't focus, pace themselves, or even delegate. Staff wore jeans and t-shirts and faced each problem with grand ideological bull sessions. Rival foreign powers could influence the situation and change it before the Clinton administration could mold a plan and implement it. Their helter-skelter approach had deadly consequences abroad. Somehow, the administration selected Somalia as a scene for international engagements. There were plenty of wars and genocides around the world. They ignored the Rwandan genocide and let the situation in Bosnia-Herzegovina escalate. I guess Somalia seemed more marketable than the others, better for the Clinton brand. The incident at Mogadishu resulted from their dithering and from their constant insistence that we, Leos, military, and so on, had to look like their perception of good guys. The administration never got over the idea that the uniformed division, the agents, and the military didn't look like what they had envisioned. What was that vision? I don't know. The administration was constantly trying to get uniformed UD officers to resemble plainclothes special agents while on the road. They wanted us to be user-friendly, which translated into do what we tell you when we tell you to do it. They wanted us to look unintimidating. Appearances really came to a head on Mrs. Clinton's detail. Eventually, personnel assigned to it regarded the honor as a punishment. It was a transfer no one wanted because of its constant stress and negativity. I vividly remember Secretary of Defense Les Aspin, George Stephanopoulos, Advisor Rahm Emanuel, and others convening about an operation in Mogadishu, the Somali capital. Though all of this was way over my pay grade, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. The three walked outside the Roosevelt Room into the hallway in front of me at my Oval Office post to reiterate what they had just discussed. They don't need tanks, Stephanopoulos insisted, as if the request was absurd and excessive. Yeah, they don't need, they agreed, listing the military's supposedly excessive requests for AC-130 gunships, armored personnel carriers, APCs, and other equipment. We don't want to look too militant, someone said. I was stunned. How does a military look too militant? It was bizarre. Somewhere in the chain of command, the decision was purely political. They agreed based on branding, and they were meddling heavily with the military. I knew from my Air Force days that no one would even see an AC-130 gunship in the sky. It'd be too high. I had no idea what caused their resistance to armored personnel carriers, or if some even knew the difference between an APC and a tank. Their nonchalance in disregarding a military request made me very uneasy. Yeah, there's no reason for that, they kept reaffirming. It's just a simple in and out. Meanwhile, President Clinton was riding, and still rides, in an armored limousine that rivaled any APC. It just enjoyed the funding to make it look like a Cadillac. In early 1993, military brass suddenly started scurrying in and out of the West Wing Situation Room. A sit-room, Situation Room operative alerted me, "We got major troops in contact in Somalia. The first reports are that we've already taken some casualties, so there's going to be a lot of guys coming and going around here. It's bad." Only then did I realize the context of Les Aspin's briefing and what George, Rahm, and others were discussing. "Shit," I said with a sigh as he walked off. "Well, where the hell is Somalia?" I said to myself. I was working so many hours I couldn't even tell what day of the week it was. A co-worker and I wheeled some globes into the Roosevelt Room and located Somalia in eastern Africa. My heart ached for the guys there. Whenever there's a terrorist attack or troops in contact, jargon for our soldiers being engaged by the enemy, every veteran's adrenaline and anger spike. Tension ratcheted up around the White House. Sundays were usually very slow and popular with tourists, but dignitaries and higher-ups from all over descended in droves. All tours were canceled, and non-essentials were sent home. The atmosphere was silent, except for the grinding of teeth and biting of nails. The Battle of Mogadishu on October 3, 1993, was part of Operation Restore Hope. We remember it now as Black Hawk Down, from the novel and subsequent film of that name by an on-the-scene journalist, Mark Bowden. Army Rangers paid a heavy price for not looking too intimidating or like invaders, valiantly fighting while stripped of the equipment they requested. Had the administration not ignorantly meddled with events, the 160 Special Forces operators of Army Rangers and Delta wouldn't have taken so many casualties. And here is what the Clinton machine didn't comprehend. Our guys wouldn't have had to inflict as many casualties either, shooting their way out against 4,000 to 6,000 Somalis with an entire city of civilians trapped in the crossfire. The Rangers became a legend that day, but lost 18 fine men and suffered 73 wounded. Years later, I realized why this always bothered me so. The Clinton leadership style had conflicting ideologies. They wanted to help, but never hurt. Like a doctor wanting to heal, but never use a scalpel or draw blood. He misses both goals abysmally. Randy Shugart and Gary Gordon, two Delta operators, won posthumous medals of honor for taking the initiative to secure one of the Black Hawk helicopter crash sites until Rangers could reinforce them. They knew the risk. They saw the enemy closing in before they even landed. At the White House, during their Medal of Honor ceremony, the father of a Delta operator became unglued, furious that he was to receive the Medal of Honor from President Clinton, who, in the father's words, was too cowardly to accept a draft to the Vietnam War at the behest of the president at the time, Lyndon Johnson. He believed President Clinton unworthy to bestow the award on his late son. His wife apologized to me and the other officers for her husband. But we felt the same way. "Ma'am, you don't have to apologize. We completely understand. Take as much time as you need," I told her, as I allowed them a buffer of privacy from the press. "Yes, we totally understood, and we were getting choked up too." Their anguish was a horrendous sight and started to change the way I looked at things. It struck me so profoundly. That father wanted his son back, and I knew this ceremony was merely part of the administration's political strategy to tamp down its Somalian scandal. Little did I know that a few of the guys who knew Shugart and Gordon and were present that day would later become so important to my life and influential in the tactical world as well. Black Hawk Down never really left me.